Hello and welcome to Martin Drive-In Podcast 124. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing one kind of superhero-y movie and one horror movie. The horror movie from 1989 is Pet Sematary, starring Dale Midkiff, Denise Crosby and Fred Gwynne. Then we move on 12 months to 1990 for Darkman, the Sam Raimi movie, starring Liam Neeson, Colin Friels, Frances McDormand and Larry Drake. So we're going from a kind of dark superhero movie to a very, very dark Stephen King adaptation. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we will get the show started, the last one of 2017. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, so how's everybody been? I assume you survived the trauma and terror that is the Christmas New Year period. We did okay. We went to the Outlaw's place for the day itself, had food, brought back leftovers because that's one of the rituals of that particular season, bringing home leftovers, and ate some of them before they went off. So basically, we ate too much, which is pretty much par for the course. Didn't drink very much. I'm not much of a drinker, but I did have a couple of beers, and I did give some beers as a present to Sally's uncle. So that was kind of cool. Not much else. We did do the post-holiday season sales, which are kind of traumatic. Bought tons of DVDs because, again, they were 20% off down at JB. So I picked up a few things there. Picked up some computer game stuff, all of that kind of thing. Spent too much money, of course, because that, again, is part of what happens there. And we're going to have a very quiet New Year's this year. We did have a couple of invitations, which was very sweet of the people involved, including one of our Patreon subscribers, Richard. We will catch up with Richard and Ali at some time in the new year. But with Sally and I decided what we want to do is just get in some prawns and other seafood and chill out at home and watch the New Year's Eve fireworks at midnight. So just this once. Sal's going through some changes in her medication, and we kind of want to low-key it until those changes settle in. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. It hasn't been a terribly exciting time, and I'm sorry I don't have any dramas and adventures to pass on to you, but that dad's given me some time to watch some things. So let me just get the letterbox up here. I'm up to 243 movies this year, mostly because I've been pissing around on computer games more than I should have. Let's see, what have I watched? Did see, I've talked about the one at Paleo, so I won't do that. I did see Bright, the Netflix movie starring Will Smith and Australian actor Joel Edgerton. It's kind of like a little bit Shadowrunny, a little bit urban fantasy. It's set in a modern world where there are orcs, elves, and other mythical creatures. And it's a police procedural, directed by David Ayer, who did Training Day, written by Max Landis. And I kind of enjoyed it. A lot of people have thrown a lot of shade on it, but I kind of liked it. I'm a sucker for that kind of thing where some of the cops are centaurs and the world's changed by having these mythical creatures and magic involved, along with the gritty street stuff of being a policeman on the streets. So for me, it kind of worked. I understand the flaws that people have pointed out in it, and how it's very broadly a parallel to race issues, particularly as they appertain to policing in an urban environment. And I can understand that. You can't really do a complex look at policing and race with a fantasy setting. It's never going to be nailed down and drilled down the way something set in our world is going to be.
But I kind of liked it. I wouldn't mind if they turned it into a series or did some sequels. I think it'd be a bit of fun. And because it came up on Netflix rather than me going to the cinema to see it, maybe I'm a little kinder to it because of that, because you pay for your Netflix, you watch all the comedy specials you like and the other shows, and you binge what you need to binge. So having just that little extra bit there with a film which tries to do something a little bit different, I kind of appreciate that. People have said that it's very much based on Shadowrun, the role-playing game, but then Shadowrun was based on a whole bunch of stuff which goes back to L. Sprague de Camp and Paul Anderson and all those other science fiction writers who started this shit in the 1930s. Thorne Smith. There are any number of people that predate Shadowrun on that kind of thing. So it's in a long tradition, and I think it did okay. I did see a documentary which came up on SBS On Demand called Becoming Bond, which is a documentary about George Lazenby and his life and his career, brief though it was, as James Bond. And they sit Lazenby down in front of a camera and he kind of narrates his life while there's a dramatisation of the events in his life occurring, which kind of works but then kind of doesn't. I think the main problem with it is that they get Josh Lawson to play George Lazenby in the dramatisations. And Josh Lawson, A, doesn't look anything at all like George Lazenby, and B, mugs it and plays it up and camps it up and comics it up as Lazenby himself. Now, Lazenby's life was very interesting and very weird in many, many ways, but I kind of think that tonally that doesn't work for me particularly well. I've seen Josh Lawson do some good things, but I've also seen him atrociously bad in a number of his acting roles. He was in Anchorman 2, for instance, playing the Australian CEO of the company that Ron Burgundy works for. But in this one, it kind of really didn't work for me. Nonetheless, I liked hearing the story of George Lazenby's life, how he went from being a car salesman in Queanbeyan to becoming James Bond and pissing it all away by simply refusing to take the contract and take the $1 million signing bonus and all those other bits and pieces there. But he very much comes across as a guy who's lived life on his own terms, has come to terms with the course of his life, and seems quite comfortable with it. There are a couple of setbacks in his life, romantically more than anything, and he really does, in an amusing way, evoke the sexual freedom of the 1960s, which is portrayed in the film in an amusing kind of way. So that came up on SBS On Demand. Unfortunately, it's probably finishing on that particular platform for Australian viewers, at least, in the next few days. So I caught up with it before it did and kind of did enjoy it. The only other thing I've watched is a TV series called Future Man, which stars Josh Hutcherson. And it kind of takes the conceit from another movie, The Last Starfighter, where somebody who's really good at computer games ends up becoming a space pilot and saving the galaxy from the bad guys and all that kind of thing. In this one, Josh Hutcherson plays a guy who lives at home with his parents and works as a janitor in a company that is trying to cure herpes. And he clocks the unbreakable computer game that's unbeatable. And when he does, he has visitors from the future who tell him that they've come back, and because he's such a good fighter, they're going to get him to help them kill the man who destroys the world. Doesn't work out like that. There's 13 episodes of this, half-hour comedy stuff. It's quite funny in places. It does have some nice acting in it. People like Keith David turn up in there and a number of other actors who really know their chops and can play it in the right tone. So it's a Hulu series, but I kind of enjoyed it. I binge-watched it. 13 half-hour episodes isn't going to take up a hell of a lot of time. Wasn't fantastically good, but I kind of like it, and I like the transgressiveness of various scenes in it, me having the kind of sick humour that I have. And, it wasn't too bad at all. So there's another season of that going to be coming up next year, so I'll look forward to watching that as well. But apart from that, I haven't been doing much in the way of viewing at the moment. I've got still an enormous stack of things to watch, including the stuff that I got from the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Chris Kringle, where I scored like a bandit as far as Blu-rays are concerned, and a lot of Criterion editions and other things as well, and a lot of Asian films that I haven't seen. So I'm really going to have to get my shit together and watch some of those, because I'm sure there's some stuff there that'd be really good for either Paleo or for Martian Drive in the future. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, we're going to do these in chronological order. So I'm going to do Pet Sematary, the 1989 adaptation of Stephen King's novel, directed by Mary Lambert and starring Dale Midkiff, Fred Gwynne and Denise Crosby.
What is this place?
I brought you here to bury Alan's cat.
Daddy, is church all right?
Why, Judd?
I have my reasons.
I dreamed he got hit by a car and you and Mr. Crandall buried him in the pet cemetery.
What did we do tonight, Judd?
What we did, Lois, was a secret.
May the Lord bless you and keep you.
Has anyone ever buried a person up there?
May the Lord make his face to shine upon you.
You're thinking thoughts best not thought of.
Daddy's gonna do something really bad.
You're thinking of putting him up there. Don't deny the thought hadn't crossed your mind.
Come back to me, Gage. Come back to us.
Paramount Pictures presents Stephen King's all-time best-selling tale of horror. Pet Sematary.
Pet Sematary is a 1989 American horror film adapted by Stephen King's novel of the same name. He wrote the script for it, and he had a little bit of control over the movie too, because he insisted that it be filmed in Maine and that the locations be kept. He suggested some locations, and he even has a little bit of a role in there playing a priest who buries a dead child. The movie was directed by Mary Lambert, who's mostly known for doing some television work. Opportunities for female directors in that stage weren't what they are today. If my voice sounds a bit different, I actually had a coughing fit after some spit went down the wrong way in my throat, and so my throat's a little bit raw, so I apologize for that. Anyway, back to the thing. Yeah, so opportunities for female directors weren't that big at the time, and she's quite competent in this. She does give a great sense of place and timing, and she really does do the horror stuff justice in this film. The movie stars Dale Midkiff, who plays a doctor called Lewis Creed, who moves from Chicago to Ludlow in Maine with his wife, Rachel, and the two kids, Gage and Ellie. Gage is about 3 years old and Ellie is much older. When they move to the country town, essentially, they end up in a large old house on a very busy road with enormous trucks racing down it. And across the road lives an old guy called Judd Crandall, played by Fred Gwynne, who people know and love from The Munsters and from Car 54, Where Are You?, back in the 1960s. And Fred Gwynne's quite good. In fact, I think he's the most valuable player in this movie, because he's Judd with a slightly exaggerated main drawl. Obviously, being Fred Gwynne, he's tall, long-faced, and he really does. He's an incredibly ambiguous character in this movie, because as the movie progresses, we don't quite understand his motives for doing things. He is ambiguous. Maybe the book, I haven't read the book, or if I have read the book, I've forgotten it. But there's a moral ambiguity to Judd that's really kind of interesting. He sits on his porch in his overalls, drinking beer and smoking cigarettes, and at some stage try to help the Creed family move in and adjust to living in this part of the world. He does show Lewis something interesting, which is a pet cemetery down a path off the property where Lewis lives. And the pet cemetery is a spiral. So they started in the centre with somebody's dog many, many decades before. and it slowly spirals outwards to the most recent dead pets because it's on a busy road near a factory. So a lot of pets obviously get run over and who die. In fact, there's a goldfish as well. So not only does Judge show him that, but he takes him on a long hike beyond the pet cemetery to an old indigenous Native American Mi'kmaq burial ground where he says that the land has gone sour. So things go on, the busy roads there, the family moves in and starts to adjust. And the wife, Denise Crosby's character, Rachel, and the kids go to visit their parents in Chicago. And while they're away, the family cat, whose name is Church for some reason, gets run over. And Judd takes Lewis to the Mi'kmaq burial ground where they bury Church. And he comes back to life, but not the same cat. He's more vicious and nasty, and there's a light in his eyes, which you can do with cats. If you ever seen a photo of your cat in just the right light, you'll get that kind of weird glassy look in their eyes, and the cat has that about it. So the cat comes back to life, which is a bit of a surprise, and the family doesn't like the cat anymore because the cat smells fairly obviously because it was dead for a long time before they resurrected it. And then the twist comes, and in an accident while their family are flying a kite, 3-year-old Gage gets hit by one of the trucks and killed. The rest of it, you can see where it's going, and it gets kind of ugly and nasty. And the movie ends in a kiss that made me throw up in my mouth just a little bit. It was very, very confronting. In fact, that was an example of the studio doing the right thing, because Paramount wanted a lot more graphic ending to the movie than was actually shot. So they reshot the ending to make it a lot more ick. And I think it works. You hear a lot about Pet Sematary, and I'm sure this is one of those movies that's in a weird place for me, because I saw it as an adult, whereas a lot of people saw it when they were young. It scared the fuck out of them. There are lots of references to this movie in the works of Trey Parker and Matt Stone in South Park. In fact, one of the South Park video games over the last few years explicitly references Judd Crandall, the character played by Fred Gwynn, in the game, and also in some episodes, I believe, of South Park. So it's one of those movies that is of a time and has, and people who grew up to be horror fans really like it and like all the references as well. So for me, I think there are some weaknesses in the film, but I like the film overall. I like the concept. I think that Mary Lambert gives it a wonderful kind of sense of place and sense of escalating dread. Now, the problems I've got with them are, for the most part, the two leads are kind of weak. Dale Midkiff, who was also in a movie, a TV series filmed in Brisbane called Time Tracks back in the early 90s, isn't that good as Lewis Creed. I don't think it really works. And Denise Crosby's character, Rachel, isn't that strong either. Everybody else is kind of very secondary to this. But the two leads kind of don't work. I think it may be a skills gap, because one of the things we don't get about Lewis, he is haunted by the ghost of one of his patients, a guy called Victor Pasco, played by Brad Greenquist, who kind of acts like, not evil, but as a afterlife Jiminy Cricket to try to steer everybody in the right direction when things get supernatural and fucked up. But it doesn't really work. We don't understand Lewis as a character apart from the fact that he's a father and a doctor. The writing, which in this case is Stephen King's fault, doesn't give us a clear idea of who he is. We get a little more backstory for Rachel and how she had a sister who had a spinal disorder and some diseases that made her very bedridden and, yeah, kind of, which haunts Rachel to this day. We get a little more of that with Denise Crosby's character, but even that's kind of a bit by the book. It's a cliche sort of situation, and the true horror of it doesn't come across, and I don't think it's the direction. The direction is fine and the direction works. I think it's definitely in the writing. Let me put it another way. With the character called Lewis, who goes on an arc from being a doctor and a dad to being somebody who performs monstrous acts as a response to some horrors in his own life. You've got to have an engaging person who will lead you on that arc and on that character arc toward the dark and nasty stuff. You need somebody who can bring an intensity to that, which really does make the punches hit home. And unfortunately, Dale Midkiff doesn't do that. And that's the big weakness. When you're sitting, it seems to sit down with Fred Gwynne and they're talking, you're not watching Lewis and his reaction to what Judd's saying. You're watching Fred Gwynne with that beautiful deep voice of his and the weird accent saying things and not saying things. I mean, that part of the writing is fine. The writing for Judd is much better than the writing for the other characters. Or maybe it's just the line delivery. I don't know. But one way or the other, his character is the one I found most interesting. So the movie's sadly lacking with that. Then also with the daughter Ellie, played by Blaise Bernthal. Who named the girl kid Blaze? I mean, it either sounds like they're going to be a pyromaniac or a stripper. But leaving that aside, the kid's underwritten too, and that kind of doesn't help because, at essence, even though there are horrible things and people and pets coming back to life when they're buried in this haunted burial ground, you really do need to... The emphasis should be on the family, on the family unit, and the breakdown of the family unit under those things. And we don't get a lot of that. We get a scene at the funeral of Gage where Lewis's father-in-law gets a bit abusive and you know, punches out Lewis, and the kind of the coffin falls off the plinth and you see a little bit of the kid's arm in the coffin, all that kind of thing. And even that's kind of, yeah, it doesn't really work. I'm fairly sure it's the writing, and I'm fairly sure it's the underwriting of the characters that really doesn't make that work. I've got a lot of respect for Stephen King as a writer of long works, but I don't think that screenwriting is his strength. Whereas if they had have got some decent script doctors in and given them a go at it too, they would have kind of shored up the weaknesses in the family dynamic that really make this not work as well as it should. There are some bits of good horror in there where Gage is resurrected and goes on a rampage with a scalpel, which is kind of interesting and horrifying, but not as horrifying as it should be for some reason. I don't know whether it's just me and my cynicism and the fact that I'm watching this in 2017 and not in 1989, that the horror doesn't come across. I think that with that kind of scene is something that somebody like Mario Bava might have done well, and the movies, that part of the movie really needed a touch of the giallo about it. And particularly with those scenes of people being attacked by artificially revived corpses, in a sense, you really do need to have a little bit of that giallo sensibility about it and really kind of ramp things up in a way that this movie unfortunately doesn't do. I'm a little bit disappointed with it. I'm glad I only paid $10 for it. But having said that, I like certain aspects of it. I like the idea of it. I like Fred Gwynne as Judd. I like the sense of the place where you've got this road with enormous trucks ripping up and down it from a factory to wherever they're going. And I like the idea, and I kind of like Brad Greenquist as a ghost. He kind of works well, even though the makeup isn't particularly fantastic, and something which both the movies in this podcast share. Nonetheless, I think that he does bring a certain eeriness, appropriate eeriness, to his role in this one. And there's also another character, a woman who comes and helps with the house called Missy Dandridge, played by an actor called Susan Blomout. And she has a short piece in the movie, which kind of works, but seems like it's shorthand for Stephen King cramming in one of the subplots from his novel into the movie to try to flesh things out and to give us a few more characters in there, because essentially there are only seven characters in this movie, leaving aside that seven or eight characters in the movie, so it doesn't feel lived in the way it perhaps it should be. And the movie had a fairly reasonable budget at the time. The budget for the film, even it was a B picture, of course, it wasn't going to be an A picture. 11.5, it made 57 million, so they definitely got their bait back. And it runs 103 minutes. And one of the other things that I found really interesting is that the movie has a feel of being part of the VHS era, where the studio knew they were going to do well on video rentals after the movie had its first release and theatrical run. And it does, there's an elusive and not quite tangible feel that movies that have an awareness of being rented after the fact for years and years and years have about them. There's a kind of 80s and 90s sensibility about films where a lot of the stuff is kind of restricted to the center of the screen, because at the time VHS didn't do widescreen very often or very well, and so most of the things we're looking at are kind of pan and scan friendly, if you know what I mean, and that kind of limits the way that things can be portrayed. I mean, I was comparing this movie to It, the 2017 version of It, and that one uses the whole of the screen really well, and things happen all over the screen because everybody has widescreen TVs now. And if you're not seeing it in the cinema, you're not going to be watching it on a cathode ray tube box with a 3:2 aspect ratio. You're going to be watching it widescreen on at least 16:9, which kind of, you know, gives the movie a different visual look than a film that is made with the realization that it's going to at some stage be cut at on either end to a pan and scan ratio for the second phase of its lifetime as a piece of art. So there's something I hadn't noticed about films before, but this movie really brought it to my attention. And that's kind of interesting, that the delivery system used to ultimately present a movie to an audience does affect the aesthetics of the movie. I don't think it happens as much now that we have home theatre, which everybody to some degree has. We have the widescreen TVs, we have the high definition stuff, and even DVD quality is pretty damn good compared to VHS. I've watched things, VHS rips on my big ass TV, the new one, and they do suffer, and you kind of lose interest because there's not that clarity there, and it becomes really annoying, which surprised me. I thought, yeah, okay, I'll be able to watch VHS things and I'll be okay. But no, I do get annoyed with the lack of definition on the screen. And there have been things, particularly episodes of TV series that I can't otherwise avail myself of, where all I can find are VHS rips. And they really do limit my ability to sit down and watch the whole film. It's my fault entirely, but I find that increasingly an interesting thing to, and I'm going to be doing this in future now that I've realized it is, watching movies from different eras, how the delivery systems affected the way the movie was originally made. I wouldn't have with prestige products. I don't think Merchant Ivory at the time gave a fuck about VHS, but with a totally commercial product like Pet Sematary, it was a consideration. But overall, I liked it. I wasn't in love with it. I wasn't as in love with it as a lot of other people are. But I definitely liked one of the characters a lot. And I think that the ending is really good, as well as being stomach-churning. So the movie does have that. There was a sequel, of course, Pet Sematary 2, because nobody has any imagination. So, and sequels that nobody asked for are not a recent phenomenon. And it wasn't like the story was incomplete the way that, say, the 2017 version of It, the second part of the story is going to be the sequel. That's a reasonable thing. But with Pet Sematary, we kind of understood the concept. It took us to a horrible place. It showed us horrible things. It did that rare thing among American films, and a child died as a part of the plot of the film. But nonetheless, I don't think that sequels to movies like this are really necessary. They're purely cash cows. And I like a sequel that brings something else to the plate, but I am increasingly cynical about sequels as a general concept, except, of course, when it comes to Marvel movies. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When we get back, I'm going to come to a much more interesting and much more fun movie, which is the 1990 Darkman by Sam Raimi, which was made because Raimi couldn't get the rights to Batman or Superman, and so created his own superhero, Darkman. And the character is aptly named because he is dark in a number of ways, and I think that for its time it was a really interesting film, showing the limitations of its budget, but nonetheless it really did deliver the goods.
What about Darkman? No.
No. Huh? What about Liam Neeson and some Darkman? No.
What about Darkman?
When Liam Neeson's
face was changing up there?
Homie was straight face changing. Yo. Now that's just Liam Neeson's acting right there,
man. Straight up, I kid you not, Academy Award caliber classic Neeson.
Come on, seriously. I mean, like, Neeson's already need to have a statue.
Liam Neeson's ain't got no. He ain't got a statue. He ain't got a statue. He ain't got a statue.
Nope. 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 Mm-hmm. The Oscar goes to Liam Neeson's Darkman. Nigga's face was changing. Mm-hmm. How hard is that?
It ain't hard, Dark. It's not hard at all.
Damn!
You're stupid, man.
Who?
No foolish heroics, if you please.
Is Darkman. They destroyed everything he had, all that he loved, everything that he was. Now, crime has a new enemy, and justice has a brand new face.
I was afraid that you wouldn't want me anymore.
Of course I still want you.
The good news is that I know who's behind our little troubles of late. Finish it.
He has the power to look like any man.
They still are both sons of witches!
But he is unlike any man.
I gotta tell you something about me.
He's a cockroach. You think you're killing? And he pops up someplace else.
In the darkest hour. There's a light that shines on every human being. But one. From director Sam Raimi. Darkman.
That, of course, was Key and Peele doing their bit about Liam Neeson and Darkman, followed by the trailer to Darkman. So Darkman, as you might have guessed by now, is a 1990 horror superhero movie. It was based on a short story Sam Raimi wrote, and it stars Liam Neeson as Peyton Westlake, a scientist who is attacked and left for dead by a ruthless mobster, Robert Durant, played by Larry Drake, after his girlfriend and attorney, played by Frances McDormand, runs afoul of a corrupt developer, played by Australian actor Colin Friels. Like Pet Sematary, this one for me is kind of VHS era genre movie, and it's kind of cool, and I show some of the limitations of special effects at the time. Nonetheless, it did spin off two sequels, Darkman 2, The Return of Durant in 1995, and Darkman 3, Die, Darkman, Die in 1996, both of which did not star Liam Neeson or Frances McDormand for that matter. They had Arnold Vosloo, the South African actor, playing Darkman in those ones. And as I recall, the sequels weren't anywhere near as good as the original, possibly because the quality of the actors deteriorated over the three films. But this one is a kind of a mashup in a way, because it's got a little bit of Phantom of the Opera about it. It's got a little bit of The Shadow, and it's definitely a superhero movie and has that master of disguise thing as well, which is kind of cool. Now, in the story, as I mentioned before, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here from Wikipedia, Peyton Westlake is a scientist who's developing a new kind of synthetic skin to help acid burn victims. He's got a problem because his synthetic skin only lasts after 99 minutes if it gets any ultraviolet light on it, including sunlight. So it's one of the reasons why he's called Dark Man, apart from the fact that he does do a lot of things at night. He was attacked by Robert Durand, played by Larry Drake, an actor who is best known for playing an intellectually disabled guy on L.A. Law for a very long time and winning an Emmy Award for it. But his character, Durand, is kind of an interesting villain, but not really. He needed to be played a bit bigger than Larry Drake did. And that's, of course, one of the weaknesses of this. You've got to have good villains. And the two villains we've got being Durant and the property developer, Lewis Strack, played by Colin Friels, with a very dodgy and ropey American accent. They're not as strong as the hero. And one of the things you've got to have with this kind of movie is enough pushback from the other side. Darkman, and Neeson's very good as Darkman / Peyton Westlake. He really does kind of bring his A-game acting to it and goes through that arc of being a man in love with a woman and a dedicated scientist frustrated by the failures of his science. And then he's blown up by the bad guys in his laboratory, tortured by them a bit before he's blown up because they want to find a certain memorandum which incriminates Lewis Strack in some very dodgy deals with Durant and bribing members of the Zoning Commission. And so they torture him a bit, blow him totally out of the building in an explosion, which his girlfriend Julie, played by Frances McDormand, witnesses, and they assume that he's dead. So he kind of crawls out of a river. He's taken to a hospital. He's got significant burns, and they do an experimental procedure on him which cuts the nerves from a certain part of his brain called the spinothalamic tract so that he doesn't live in constant pain. But then that also means that he can't feel things with his skin, which is a big problem, particularly if you want to continue a relationship with your fiance. So one of the things is Westlake staggers out of the hospital, and one of the side effects of having his spinothalamic tract severed is that because he can't feel things, he gets an incredible adrenaline rush when he gets angry and gets kind of superhuman strength as a part of that. And to a certain extent, he's not affected by pain, so that gives him a certain invulnerability and a certain resistance to taking certain actions. So he's got this incredible adrenaline spike. He's got the ability to not feel pain. He's got the ability to use his technology to put fake skin on himself and to, in a very early version of it, 3D print other people's faces so that he can appear to be anybody at any time. So he sets up a laboratory in an abandoned building and decides that he's going after the bad guys to, in a sense, get his life back, while in parallel he's reassociated himself with Julie, who doesn't know that he's disfigured because he wears his own face as a mask. And the problems involved in that, because she is started a new relationship with Strack, very tentatively a new relationship with him. And as Peyton comes back on the scene, but is very much changed by his experiences, she's kind of conflicted about what to do about her life and her relationships. So this being a Sam Raimi movie, it does show a little bit of the influences of his early career, very much as a cult filmmaker in the Evil Dead movies and things like that. He hasn't quite shed that. When maybe he needed to shed it a little bit more, there are a couple of bits of Dark Man where he plays things comedy. There's a scene where Dark Man is hanging from a helicopter on a cable and gets pushed through a bunch of buildings and over a freeway overpass and all sorts of other bits and pieces which are played comedically. And that doesn't really seem tonally to fit with the rest of the movie, because it's a very much a almost a kind of Dark Knight-ish feel to it. One of the reasons why Raimi did this was he couldn't get the rights to do a Superman or a Shadow, Batman or a Shadow movie. So he created his own superhero, who was a kind of combination of the two. And I like Duckman as a hero. I think that it works well. I know there are a number of comics as well that were put out, and novels as well. Let's see. In 1990, Marvel put a 3-issue adaptation of it. And in 2006, Dynamite Entertainment published a crossover that pitted Darkman against Sam Raimi's Ash Williams in an Evil Dead Army of Darkness crossover. And there were also some novelizations of the Darkman movies that were put out at the time, because at that stage people still did novelizations of movies, which is a decreasing part of the market these days. People just don't read as much as they did and don't need a book adaptation of a film. It does happen occasionally, but it hasn't happened a lot. The only one I know of at the moment is Pat Cadigan has done a novel adaptation of Battle Angel Alita for the new James Cameron movie that's coming out. So that will be interesting, because Pat Cadigan, fantastic writer, one of the seminal cyberpunk writers. So I might actually pick up a copy of that, because I like Battle Angel Alita. I like the trailer, even though there is an Uncanny Valley bit with the size of the protagonist's eyes. But it's a Robert Rodriguez action film based on a very fine Japanese anime and manga, I believe, as well. So I'm definitely there. I definitely want to see that film. But, novelizations are definitely something that's fallen by the wayside a bit. Now, one of the cool things about this movie is the acting. Liam Neeson's very good. Frances McDormand, who's about to win an Oscar, she's like got the inside track running to get an Oscar for her latest 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which I do want to see, and I hear fantastic things about it. Frances McDormand, not really the obvious choice for this kind of role, because even though she did do some genre films, she was in Blood Simple, and she's married to Joel Coen, in fact has been married to Joel Coen since 1984. But genre films haven't really been a big part of her filmography. I'm just going to look through it now. She was in things like Raising Arizona. She was in Crime Wave too, which is really weird, playing a nun, very early in her career. Miller's Crossing, of course. Darkman, Barton Fink, Hudsucker Proxy, Shortcuts. She was in Aeon Flux, which I don't remember her being in, but she was definitely in it. And Transformers Dark Side of the Moon. So she has done some genre films and a bit of voice work and things like that. And, of course, she was in Hail Caesar very briefly and very funnily. But, I like Frances McDormand as an actor. She's really good at everything. And, of course, Fargo. But, again, she's not the kind of actor who you expect to play the love interest in a superhero movie, because she's not a classically beautiful faced person. Great character and attractive. But as a rule in that kind of film, they did tend to cast for looks first rather than acting ability. But what they did in this one, which takes it out of the ordinary, is that in Darkman, they put Liam Neeson in there, Frances McDormand's in there, and the supporting cast is a bit hit and miss, nothing big. But of course, you've got budget limitations. The budget was only $16 million. It did make $48.8 million, but the budget didn't allow them to kind of go with well-known supporting actors. I think they wanted to put more money into the special effects and to put the story across than they did hiring the actors. And at the time, Liam Neeson wasn't a fantastically well-known actor. He wasn't the Liam Neeson we know now. He was pretty early in his career. I mean, it was only after this that he did things like Schindler's List and Michael Collins, a 1998 adaptation of Les Miserables. He was also in a Star Wars movie, though I don't quite remember in what way. I believe he died early. Larry Drake, of course, had a long history in television. But Colin Friels was an interesting one. I actually saw Colin Friels on stage back in the day. He was in a play called Il Magnifico that Robin Archer wrote back in the 80s, which I saw on stage. There was a time back in those days where people who were unemployed could go and see the best theatre in Sydney at one session per run of a play at the Nimrod Theatre and the other major theatre companies in Sydney. So you'd rock up there on an afternoon and they'd do the whole play for you, and most of the audience were people who were able to show unemployment benefits. So I saw Il Magnifico with a friend of mine, and Friels was fantastic. He was playing Lorenzo de' Medici, and it was played for fun. The Pope was played like a Queensland property developer, so there was tons of outrageous stuff in there, and it was a lot of fun. But I remember that on stage, Colin Friels was dynamic. He was just fantastic in the role. In this one, less so. I think he was fighting through the accent, but he does have a couple of moments when he is fighting Peyton Westlake high on some high steel in the construction of a building that he's doing. And you see little flashes of Colin Friels acting there where he really does bring his A-game to it. But on the whole, the role's kind of underwritten. So many of the movies I've been reviewing on the podcast lately, you can see actors fighting through underwritten roles. And it, of course, it's part of the gig. It's part of what they're brought on for. But I think everything, in essence, in movies comes from the writing. And where characters are kind of underwritten, then it weakens the whole structure of things. And maybe there's not enough time to do the rewrites that maybe are required by a particular property. But I really like having even character roles where people are given something to chew on, you know, a little bit of gristle on the bone. Never hurts with that kind of thing. But Dark Man, it was fun revisiting it, actually, because it does have a little comparison with the Tim Burton Batman movie. There's a little bit of the feel of that where Raimi was subtly influenced by that, which came out a year before Dark Man. That may have been enhanced by the fact that both of them had scores by Danny Elfman. So Danny Elfman's probably wrote the music for both of those within a year of each other. And so he might have been in the same headspace at the time. But in spite of that, it works really well. We get a strong sense of the tragedy of Peyton Westlake's life. He's a totally innocent bystander in the corporate shenanigans that are going on there. And at the start of the movie, he's played very much like an innocent. He's a scientist. He's definitely in love with Julian. She's in love with him. And that you do see some of the cuteness of their relationship at the start of the film. So that works to enhance the tragedy of the fact that suddenly he's this disfigured man in the night who can't control his own emotions, who's hideously disfigured. There's a scene where Peyton, wearing a mask, and Julie go to a fun fair and see a freak show, and he loses it because of that, because he knows that underneath the fake skin, he himself is a freak. And I'll use that word advisedly because that's the word used in the movie. But it's really, I think Liam Neeson plays the arc of the character well and brings us the necessary pathos in that. It would have been nice to see him in the other films as well, because Arnold Vosloo doesn't have anywhere near the chops of Liam Neeson. And as Batman's defined by the death of his parents, Dark Man's defined by the fact that he's disfigured and has these anger issues, which are part of the surgery that he underwent to control the chronic pain he would have been feeling otherwise. And so you've got a couple of strong and valid reasons for him being a very unusual superhero in a sense. And I like that. I think that maybe a remake of Dark Man would not be off the cards, I think, if you could get a strong actor in there. I definitely think that it would work, and I think it may be something that somebody may want to do, because I also think that this was one of the movies that was waiting for certain technologies to become available, and at 1990 they weren't yet available. Having a bit of CG in there, having something else that could kind of give us the story in a superhero format much easier than this movie did. And there are some really good practical and physical stunt effects in this movie. And also having some villains who are a little bit stronger might have helped the film. But you do have to accept that it's of its time. They used the available technologies, the available budget, and stayed true to... It was very much a Sam Raimi film, so I don't believe there was much studio interference with this one. It was never going to be an A picture for the studio, and I'm just finding out which studio it was. Universal. It wasn't an A picture for Universal, so they kind of did let him have his head a little bit. We also get a couple of people in smaller roles who are kind of interesting. You got Jenny Agutter in there as a doctor who treats Peyton Westlake's burns. You also get a momentary cameo by Bruce Campbell right at the end of the film, which was kind of cool. And Sam Raimi and John Landis have cameos as hospital staff. That was something that was done very much in those days, where genre directors would turn up in cameos in each other's films. I mean, even in a movie like Spies Like Us, the Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd movie, you've got Ray Harryhausen and other people doing cameos in minor roles in this film, and that's kind of cool. But it's something you don't see as much these days. Of course, you've got Taika Waititi playing in Thor Ragnarok, but it's actually a featured role. It isn't a little cameo kind of thing. But it is very much of its time, which is kind of cool. And it's one of those little tropes you kind of remember with a bit of fondness, which, it's weird that you're getting nostalgic for things that happened in the 1990s, because, you know, as we all know, I've had a number of birthdays. And so it feels slightly odd to be nostalgic for the 90s, where in the past I was nostalgic for the 60s and the 70s, and still am to a great extent. But being nostalgic for the 90s feels a little bit like a suit that doesn't quite, it's a little tight in the shoulders. So, but nonetheless, I enjoyed the movie, revisiting a lot. I don't know that I'm going to see the sequels, because even though they do continue the story, I think that the original is a better as a standalone because of the quality of everything involved. Now, I'm just going to take a quick Wikipedia look at the sequels as well, because I think, Darkman 2 wasn't directed by Sam Raimi, nor was Darkman 3. They were both directed by somebody called Bradford May, who doesn't even seem to have an IMDb presence. Here we go. We're going to have to dive into Wikipedia presence. We're going to have to dive into IMDb. Bradford May, the guy who did the Darkman sequels. Let's see, what else did he do? NCIS, he did episodes of JAG. He did a TV movie called Groomzilla, which is being released. TV movie called The Time Capsule, so very much a TV movie director. And it's always a kind of red flag when you look at sequels to movies. Is most of the work in 1990s television for the directing? You go, yes, okay, but they were looking for a director who would work fairly cheaply and fast, but not necessarily with a lot of nuance and subtlety. And it does seem like this is definitely one of those directors who also did a TV movie about Madonna, which shows you the kind of level that they were working at with that. Which is a bit of a shame, but Darkman, for me, Darkman's a standalone. I don't need to see the sequels. I probably will at some stage, but not right now. There's still plenty of time. And the stack of to-be-watched things sitting to the right of the television at the moment is heading towards, it's not there yet, but it's going to get a meter tall if I don't do something about it. And I've really got to kind of work my way through that, because there are so many good things there that I want to check out and haven't yet availed myself of. So just to finalize on that one, I definitely think it's, there aren't many movies that I really think need to be remade and reimagined. But I think Darkman is such a cool protagonist, and a mashup of so many other things, like The Shadow, as I said, and The Phantom of the Opera, and a number of other things, and has that flexibility because he could be literally anyone. And that'd be a cool thing to put into a Darkman movie. If I was redoing a Darkman movie, and of course nobody is ever going to let me anywhere near a project like this, or in fact a movie project of any kind, I'd be doing a bit where Darkman gets acting lessons from somebody and learns how to appear to be other people and kind of enhances that part of things while still doing it in the masks that he makes last 99 minutes to 100 minutes. So, taking acting lessons in 100-minute chunks might be an interesting thing to throw in there. Even a TV series. I think a Darkman TV series would be kind of cool. And I could see it working well. And with the way TV is going at the moment, and TV budgets in particular, I think that a Darkman television series could be kind of interesting. It wouldn't need to necessarily be a 24-episode series, but 13 would be enough. And if they could get someone on, say, Hulu or Netflix or Amazon to take a look at it, I definitely think that there are some legs here and there's some unexplored aspects of the concept that might well avail themselves of an adaptation. So that's about it for Darkman. Did enjoy it. I enjoyed it a lot more than I enjoyed Pet Cemetery for exactly the converse reasons. One of them had actors who were too weak. This one had strong actors. So that's probably the takeaway on that. And Darkman, you know, with the kind of manky bandages and the hat and the long duster coat on, is a very cool protagonist. So anyway, it's the end of 2017. In fact, I'm recording this one on the 31st of December 2017. And it's been a year of a lot of changes for me. It's been a year of a lot of changes in our world and in our society. I mean, we've had the first year of Trump. We've had the Me Too thing and the revelation about the true nature of a number of famous men using their mostly economic and sometimes political influence to harass and assault women. So that's going to be a change that we're going to see ongoing in 2018. I'm sure there are going to be many, many more people revealed to be predators during the year. So, and for me personally, it's been a year where I've kind of retired. I went through all of the hassles of redundancy and all that kind of thing. And I went through a lot of changes in how I see myself, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's like any kind of drastic change. There's not a drastic change in your life that's not going to hurt while you're going through it. And afterwards, you understand the reason why you went through it. And I'm kind of getting to that stage now. Next year, I'm putting in a lot more structure into my days. I've had 4 months since I stopped working now. And it's about time that I put some structures in and work towards the things that I'm passionate about and the things that I really want to do. And that's, you know, kind of interesting, but it also means that I've got to have a lot more discipline about the things I do, particularly about the podcast. The first thing I did right with the podcast as I'm going through this process is getting this decent microphone and learning how to use it well. I think that that's helping a lot. And the one thing I really want to do is, in the new year, I'm definitely getting more guests on board because it's a lot more fun doing the podcast with a guest. And in spite of that, where necessary, I am going to persevere with the just me podcasting. But I'm optimistic about the future. I think paralleling my own changes, these kind of changes in what some people call political correctness and other people call justice and fairness, and I'm on the justice and fairness side, I think that, yeah, these changes are painful when you go through them as a society or as an individual, any kind of drastic change. But I think that a lot of it depends on your attitude. We are trying to make the world better. And the fact that you've got Trump sitting on the other end of the seesaw weighing things down means that more and more of us are moving to balance that, even if it's just on a personal political basis or a personal social basis. We're learning that the things that are important to us, and we're learning to nurture the things that encourage our better nature rather than our worse nature. There have been times in all our lives when our worst natures have persevered because it's easier to be an asshole. It's difficult to be a good person when you're under stress and hassled and you haven't had enough sleep and you've got worries about certain things and you've got obligations and you've got all this stuff on your plate. Being a good person under those circumstances, it really is more difficult than just being an asshole. But on the other hand, being an asshole means you're an asshole. And none of us should be aspiring to that. So anyway, I hope you have a good New Year's Eve if you hear this beforehand, or I hope you had a good New Year's Eve. I know that the Northern Hemisphere is basically a fridge that hasn't been defrosted in a couple of years. It's incredibly cold up in particularly North America. So everybody, look after yourselves. I mean, stay safe. Down here, it's going to start getting very, very hot. So again, down here, everybody stay safe. Later in the week, it's going to get up to 39 degrees centigrade here in Melbourne. And that inevitably kills people. But anyway, I hope 2018 is everything you need. I know that I'm going to be have my own challenges in 2018, but I like the fact that I've got more freedom than I had for most of 2017, and that creatively I've got some groovy things I can do. So take care of yourselves. I'll be back next week, next year, with another Paleo Cinema podcast and then with a Martian Drive-In podcast. Take care and keep watching the skies. And now here, of course, are the credits. And here are the credits. Thank you to Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris our Music Director, Jan our Dialect Coach, Armin our Key Grip, Matt our Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris the Camera Operator, Christopher the Gaffer, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy our Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Set and Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy our Donut Wrangler, Tim our New York Unit Director, Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor, Steve our Monster Effects Guy, Dylan our Goat Wrangler, Eric our Set Security Lead, Richard H the Set Photographer, Mark D Extra, David L the Extra, Richard C our Transportation Co-Captain, Carrie L our Tasmanian Consultant, and Kerry C our Accountant. We also have Sally our Continuity Girl, and of course the other Sally who is always helpful and encouraging and wonderful. So thank you very much to all of the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donating as little as $1 per month.